The reading from the lectern this morning is our text, and a curious text it is. The fact that the director of worship has coupled this text with the seventh petition of the Lord's Prayer suggests that he's inviting me to say something about prayer in my sermon today. So, let me proceed to do just that. It's so easy to trivialize this text. That, I fear, is the chief danger of treating Jacob's encounter with God as an object lesson in prayer. We may end up with moralistic goodies like, hang in there and God will give you what you want, or if nothing else, prayer will prove to be a growing up experience. Both these truths, of course, are present in the text, but they're a long way from the whole truth. Wrestling with God in prayer is a common theme associated with this text, but somehow we have to find a better way of saying it than that. Our words mustn't cheapen the insights this text contains. Triteness, I guess, is more the danger than untruth. Distortion is the other danger, not only with this text, but with most any text on prayer. You can see it every week on TV. Prayer is held up as a sort of magic by which we zap God, or he zaps us. God is a kind of genie at our beck and call whenever we rub our fingers together in the act of prayer. All we have to do is touch the hand of the man on the other side of the television screen, and we'll feel power surging through us. The long and difficult encounter Jacob experienced with God in our text ought to correct that distortion. But it's just as easy to distort in the opposite direction and demiracalize prayer. Prayer remains a power. It is a sort of magic, just not the kind of hocus-pocus some televangelists make money on. But prayer does get answers. It moves mountains. Ask and it shall be given you. Knock and it shall be opened unto you. Seek and ye shall find. All things whatsoever ye shall ask in prayer, believing, ye shall receive. The truth of these Bible passages is clear and direct, and no amount of sophisticated tinkering with prayer can reduce it to a mere spiritual experience in which nothing more happens than growth in our understanding of God. Jacob's getting what he wanted in our text, and even more than he wanted, ought to correct that distortion. One other distortion of our text is possible. We are not necessarily heard for our much speaking or for our pretty speaking either. Don't get me wrong. This is not a veiled crack at the many formal and eloquent prayers in our rich liturgical tradition. Prayers authored by people close to God that fortunately express what I so often vainly struggle to say in my verbal burping. Yet the fact remains that there is also a commendable brevity, simplicity, and informality to prayer. Three favorite models come to mind. The directive after Luther's evening prayer, then go to sleep at once and in good cheer. Ransom's prayer in C.S. Lewis's Paralandra, glory be to God, I'm tired. Finally, Platon Karatáev's nightly prayer in Tolstoy's War and Peace. Let me lie down like a stone, O God, and rise up like new bread. Okay, preacher, so much for what the text doesn't say. How about getting to what it does say? Good advice. Just bear in mind that what it does say is only a portion of the picture. That whole we call prayer is always greater than the sum of its parts. First, prayer can be an arduous encounter with God, an ordeal of sorts. It isn't always easy. It may appear we're losing the battle. We may go away limping from the experience. The problem we discuss with God just won't go away. The physical, mental, and personality limitation we lay before Him keeps haunting us. The familiar temptation insists on popping up again. Remember Jesus' prayer in Gethsemane? It involved literal sweat and blood. A good reminder for all of us. Secondly, the ordeal of prayer, if and when it is that, is good for us all around. Look at Jacob. He not only got the blessing he wanted, but even more. He saw God face to face and survived. He got a new identity. No longer was he Jacob, the cheat and deceiver. He is a new person. He is now Israel. Deliver us from evil, says the seventh petition, and so often the evil is ourselves. That's one of the reasons prayer may be an ordeal. Eager as he is to hear us and help us, God is no pushover. Often he must oppose us when our sinful will is out of sync with his good and saving will. He challenges and evaluates our request. When our will lines up with the genuine good he intends for us, he lets us prevail. Graciously, he gives us not only what we ask for, but also the blessing of a new identity. Through his gospel, he makes us into new creatures, in whom old things pass away, and all things begin to become new. Thirdly, look at the encouraging gospel in this text. And that, I believe, is the main point of this text, the gospel, with the implications for prayer. We do not have a standoffish God. He condescends to mix it up with us. Wrestling is too hackneyed a term to describe what God does, and dialogue is too tame and trendy a word for it. God engages intimately with the creature he made and saved. He takes risks, so great is his goodness. And he loves to lose. He loves to lose. Remember the woman of Cana? Be it reverently said that our Lord wasn't satisfied until he lost the battle of logic he initiated with her. Pascal once said that when it comes to prayer, God confers upon us humans the dignity of causality. C.S. Lewis, in a sonnet, describes God allowing our weak prayers to move as very muscles his delaying fingers, who in his longanimity and love for our small dignities enfeebles for a time his power. At the conclusion of their encounter, God told Jacob, "You have struggled with God and with men." He meant that Jacob had struggled with ordinary mortals like Laban and Esau, and had even struggled with God himself. But isn't God's statement true in still another sense? A sense our text probably doesn't intend. The very person Jacob wrestled with was both God and man. Jacob's encounter was with the pre-incarnate Christ, a spirit by nature, assuming for a time the form of a man. That phenomenon in theology we saddle with intimidating words like anthropomorphism and theophany. How predictive, in a way. The day would come centuries later when this spirit, the Son of God, would literally become a man, conceived in a woman's body, born in a stable, growing up in a carpenter shop, walking the dusty paths of Palestine, dying on a cross, lying in a grave, coming back to life again, and still retaining his human flesh at the right hand of his Father in heaven. No anthropomorphism this time. Nothing temporary about this. This is the real thing. This is the God who became man for us and for our salvation. It is that incarnation and all it involved that is the basis for the graciousness of God to Jacob in our text. And it is that incarnation that has made each of us, like Jacob, a prince who in prayer has God-given power with God and with people.